Position number 21287, Rule 4.
One crack, Rule 4. Any other memories from the Ardennes?
Very uncomfortable. It was a lot of snow and slush and mud, which restricted quite a lot of vehicle movement. It was, I remember, I had to go to a map reference, and I had no means of telling where I was, and I went into an American headquarters place, a lot of American officers there, and I said, could you give me this map reference where I am now? I wanted to try and find out where I was. And they asked me for my papers, like book, AB64, and of course I didn't have it on me. They wouldn't give me a map reference. They wouldn't have anything, you know, they weren't sure who we were, and they wouldn't help in any way, shape or form. So that is a sign that it was, you know, you had to beware of who was about, who nobody seemed to know. Although we had to, I think, soon after that, we had to go, Liège was the town, I think. Was it Liège?
Yes.
I think. Yeah. We didn't actually go over there. We our signal section, our battery was in reserve, I think, at that time. But it was most uncomfortable. Very cold. Nothing much to say about the Ardennes except that it was quite, not much shellfire that I remember, but just very cold and wet and damp. And in fact, I have read in that book down by my side that they had a job to move our battery, I believe. I think it was Major Goddard, I think he was the one that was the movement. But
what happened to you after the Ardennes?
Well, it had to be back up to towards the east of Arnhem, towards Hengelo, because that was one of the first towns that I remember. We liberated. And of course that Hengelo becomes reasonably close to the German border. A few canals had to be crossed around there, and when we were there last year, we went out this 20 canal, and I just read about it. The Worcesters, they got within 15 feet of this canal to cross it on the bridge, and within 15 feet of it, and the Germans blew it up, and so they had to put a temporary bridge across. but that was where, around that area, I can't mention place names because I don't have to see these maps that I got, you know, to tell you. But from there we went on down to the Reichsveld Forest, and awful. That was pretty grim.
Why?
Reichsveld. Well, there was things I can think of one dawn I I had to go to meet the OP officer, and I went past a field and I saw this line of infantry chaps all in a firing position. I thought they were pretty still, and they were all dead. And there was like parallel roads, and went across and come back down the other parallel road, and in the middle of the road was a pair of legs. No body, just khaki trousers and boots and spats, but no body. And then there was British dead there, and I don't know whether I'd better tell you this, but I don't want it to go on tape. This is only what we heard, this is not fact, it hasn't been written about, so I don't know whether I'll tell you. Shall I?
Why not? The tape's on.
Well, what the story went, as there was dead on both these parallel roads, the story went, and I can't vouch for this because I can't prove it, although it is what we were told. There was infantry were supposed to advance both roads together and then form, you know, the pincer movement. Well, one of the infantry groups started an hour after the other one. Consequently, the one infantry group were in a position where they were supposed to be, and of course they saw movement which wasn't supposed to be there. Consequently, now I don't know whether this is what happened. I would think they both brought fire down on each other, but I wouldn't put that. I wouldn't want that to go into the war museum because I can't prove anything.
You made it plain that it was just a rumor, anyway.
It's a rumor. But what we did hear was the officer who went at the wrong time was sent back to this country. But and that was why the amount of German prisoners and young lads and, well, I mean, really old men, you know, it saddened me to think, like, chaps of that age, I mean, they're easily 50s and 60s, should be herded about like cattle, you know. It was a very sad time for me, really, to see all this.
What else happened to you in the Reichswald?
Well, the one thing I can remember, I was in this sort of field, and I heard these awful sounds swishing, and I thought, dear, I never heard anything. I was used to gunfire, loud gunfire, all sorts of gunfire, and machine guns, and 303s, and all the rest of it. But, I mean, this noise did frighten me a bit, because I didn't know what it was. I thought, I couldn't think. Have any idea? And it was the Canadians, and they had rockets. They had rockets on the, you know, they would send these rockets off at a very fast, you know, very fast. And this swishing was the rockets going out of the whatever you call it
tubes.
Yeah, tubes. Yeah. That's another thing. That's one thing I can remember about the Reichswehr, and of course the movement was pretty bad. And then from there we went on, we had to go through Germany, and that was where my friend who I spoke to you earlier on, who lost the Sergeant Major's hat, we were going down, I'm afraid I can't tell you the names of the places, we were going through Germany, and we were told to carry on, and even though there's pockets, you had to carry on, and Lieutenant Skinner, and he was our GPO at that time, he went down this little lane to go to a farmhouse to see if he could have a gun position there, and they were machine gun from behind, and the friend of mine who was the radio operator, he got wounded quite badly in the arm and various parts of his body. He lived, he didn't die, but he was very shook up. He had to be flown back to this country. And so that was the young fella that fired into the ceiling. And so that was another one we lost. And pretty awful that was, because there was German 88s, I think. They're up this road, and they fired shells on our, not on our, well, our battery was there, but it was the 477 battery. That was our one of, there was three batteries, and the casualties were not many, but they were quite severe. The Sergeant Major Ramsden, who was a real, he could have been out of the army, he was 20 odd years and in the army, and he could have been home with his wife, and he was killed instantly by the shell fire of an 88. He was in the back of a 1500 weight, and it landed right on top of the 1500 weight. So it was pretty awful. It was one of our signalers wounded, and that made about 6 out of 10 either killed or wounded, and including me, that was 7. So we were getting a bit depleted, but quite a nasty situation. We were looking up into this woodland, and the Germans were up in there, the pocket. But I believe divisional fire was brought down on the, and the Germans quickly left their positions and went elsewhere. One of the worst situations I can do was at a place called Goch. That was in the middle of Goch. Oh, there was awful shell fire and machine guns. You never knew where it was going to strike next. And when shells fall on roads, they make such an explosion, and there's such flying metal that it's a bit frightening. Fortunately, we managed to come out of there unscathed. And then fairly quickly went through Germany to Fallingbostel. It was a British prisoner of war camp. I believe British troops were kept there, and as prisoners in Fallingbostel, and later become a displaced persons from Poland were kept there under our control.
Did you see anything of prisoners there?
German prisoners. We saw all SS prisoners, yeah, in another place near to there. They used to work for us. Yeah, they used to work for us. Well, of course, when chaps are prisoners, they're a bit different to what they would be if they were in opposition. Well, they're still in opposition, but they're prisoners. They would. They used to swap with a lot of people, although he didn't go in for himself. They used to swap watches for cigarettes, things like that. That was. Where are we?
Fallingbostel.
Yes. We spent a few months there, and then we went on to a place called Velsroda, which is not very, very far away from Sella. And that was where we were at the end of the war, and then we stayed there until we were demobbed.
Were you in the occupation of Germany?
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, the actual occupation of Germans, it was very quiet.
How did you get on with the Germans?
I got on quite well with the Germans, actually. I must admit, I rather like the Germans, but we had trouble with the Polish displaced personnel. I can't remember what it, I know we had to do a early morning raid on this Polish, that was at Fallingbostel, and did an early morning raid looking for various things. I didn't have anything to do with the Poles, but I got on very well with the Germans. We weren't allowed at the start to, as they say, fraternise, but eventually that rule was lifted, and the German girls used to come to their dances, and we got on very well. I rather like the Germans, although I have heard since that they're getting back to their what they used to be like, you know.
You were saying earlier that you thought you'd become bomb happy after that.
Yeah.
Hits on the head. What made you feel that?
Well, I'll tell you what. You turn to the.
You just go from memory.
Well, actually, when you've been hit about a bit, like I'd had quite a knock in the head, and it made my body, half of my body was like not exactly numb, but I couldn't. I carried on after I'd stopped, and it looked at me and said, "Well, we'll go back to the maintenance position, maintenance place. We're in a farmhouse," and I said, "This jeep's pulling one way," and it wasn't pulling. It was my body was all cockeyed. Do you see what I mean? I was I thought that it was pulling to the left, but it wasn't. It was just that my right side was all not exactly numb, but not much use in it. And so I used to see, when I was in hospital, I used to hear chaps talking a load of gibberish. The biggest load of rubbish you ever heard of. And that was the effects of in the ears and everything to do with warfare was having an effect on their mind. And that was really, I suppose, what I meant by bomb happy. It was a saying for another saying, gone a bit doolally. If you read that.
Yes, you've written something for a Dutch girl here who asked you to write your war memories.
Well, that was it. No, I didn't send that to her. I didn't think she wanted to read that. At the end paragraph, you'll see what I mean. I didn't want that recorded, what was on that bottom of that paragraph. Not very proud of it, but it's what happened.
How do you feel now about having served with the Royal Artillery?
I feel quite proud of the fact that I served. I mean, after a very inauspicious start, I proud really to think that I did serve. Although for about 30 years after the war, I never thought anything. It's not until the last few years that I really thought about the war, you know. It went right out of my mind for quite a number of years, 30 years, I expect. Because we have these reunions, and I never went for many, many years. Now I go every year. Although this is going to be the last one this year, I think.
Did you have any after effects from having served?
Well, yeah, I'm reasonably deaf. I sometimes get the tight feeling that I got at that time. You get the tight feeling in your head, you know, can't explain it, but it's something that I got when I was hit. You get a tight feeling, you feel as if it's going to burst. I mean, now, do you know what affects me? I cannot, you know, when you blow a balloon up, I can't blow a balloon up in case it pops. I can't stand that. Well, that's it. That is the effect of warfare, I think, because I never used to worry about it. And if I see my grandchildren blowing their balloons up, I don't say nothing. I don't say, hey, don't blow that balloon up. But I'm fearing that it's going to go up, you know. So it does have effects in a small way. It's nothing to worry about, you know. Nothing that I'd ever want to make anything of, you know. But it did. It still does affect me slightly. Yeah.